As we wrap up 2024, the pop culture experts at Consequence are back with our annual report, celebrating the year's best in music and entertainment. And this time, we're bringing you Something Extra, a brand new podcast series exclusively on Amazon Music. Get inside access with interviews featuring the year's biggest artists, actors, and filmmakers, plus discussions with the Consequence team on our best of the year lists. You can tune in with Amazon Music Unlimited, now free for 3 months. For a limited time, get 3 months of Amazon Music Unlimited free by visiting tryamazonmusic.com/COS. You'll get over 100 million songs in stunning HD sound, on demand and ad-free, plus top ad-free podcasts, including the Consequence Annual Report podcast. Even better, every Amazon Music Unlimited subscriber now gets one free audiobook from Audible each month. So celebrate the best of 2024 with Consequence's Annual Report all December at consequence.net. And don't miss the companion podcast by signing up for 3 free months of Amazon Music Unlimited at tryamazonmusic.com/COS or clicking the link in the show description. That's tryamazonmusic.com/COS.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Buck Dharma from Blue Oyster Cult, and I'm giving you the story behind the song on the Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome, listeners, to the story behind the song. I'm your host, Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media. In this very special encore episode, and just in time for Halloween, I revisit my interview with Don Roser, a.k.a. Buck Dharma, lead guitarist, singer, and songwriter for legendary classic rock band Blue Oyster Cult. I asked him about the band's haunting classic track, Don't Fear the Reaper. The song is a rock masterpiece with an unforgettable and eternal timeless guitar riff and melody married to equally timeless lyrics that tell a complete story about the human condition, and then production that elevates it all to an overall mood that is transcendent. Reaper was able to achieve all these things even in spite of, or maybe even because of, its surprising use of cowbell. That's right. Saturday Night Live elevated both the song and the cowbell to new and very different heights, with Will Ferrell's hilarious sketch in 2000 that featured Christopher Walken's unforgettable deadpan as Bruce Dickinson saying,
"Guess what? I got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell."
And now both Reaper, the song, and Will Ferrell's SNL sketch are considered to be classic. So as you get ready to go trick-or-treating, take a listen as we take another deep dive into the story behind Blue Oyster Cult's classic timeless track, Don't Fear the Reaper. Don, great to see you.
Thank you, Peter. I'm also known as Buck Dharma professionally.
I'm going to switch gears then. I'll call you Buck. So it's obviously it's a really big year. How do you feel about 50 years?
I never would have thought 50 years, you know. Initially, when we got signed by Columbia Records back in the day, I figured that we'd make one or two, maybe three records, and then, you know, do something else for the rest of my life. And now it's 50 years later.
Yeah. And by the way, I usually ask this question at the end, but since you mentioned it, figure out what you do the rest of your life. If you didn't become Buck Dharma and Blue Oyster Cult, what do you think you would have done?
I think if the man had, you know, peaked and burned out, I would have gone into record production and the engineering side of it, which I've always enjoyed. And I thought I would be pretty good at it, you know. If it happened today, I don't know, I'd make ships and bottles or something. You know?
you were a chemical engineer, right?
I went to school just not with any particular aim, but you know, I had good SATs for engineering school.
And yeah.
Both my parents worked in the defense industry on Long Island, where I grew up. At that time, it was quite thriving. And so I was just sort of steered in that direction. And I was influenced by my high school chemistry teacher who got me, you know, psyched up for chem. So anyway, I got into a bar band in college. I met the original drummer of Blue Oyster Cult, Albert Bouchard, there, and that became basically the core of what became Blue Oyster Cult eventually.
Yeah, no, it's amazing how things happen. One moment leads to a completely transformed life. The classic song, Don't Fear the Reaper, from the 1976 album, Agents of Fortune, written by and sung by you. One of the, as I said, and as we all know, one of the most classic of classic rock songs of all time. It's considered to be a masterpiece by many, including Pitchfork. Rolling Stone named it as the song of the year in 1976, and it's top 500 of all time, with easily top 500 of all time. I've always felt that Don't Fear the Reaper is the perfect song. It's in my top 10 of all time. I just think that everything about it sonically, lyrically, the storyline, the feeling that it evokes, all of that is just classic and timeless. So first, take me on a guided tour of how you did get into the music business. You mentioned meeting your bandmate and becoming Blue Oyster Cult, but just even before then, how did you go that direction?
My dad was a sax player. My dad lived to be 94, and he just passed away a couple years ago. But he was a World War II veteran, and he played sax semi-professionally. You know, he passed up the full-time thing, but he played weekends as a club musician most of his life. He played pretty much right up to the end of his life. So he got me into music, and I absorbed a lot of his era music, the big band, jazz, and the 50s cool school. And he used to take me to shows, like matinee shows, you know, but at clubs on Long Island when jazz musicians came through. I saw Maynard Ferguson, I saw Chet Baker. So I was familiar with it, really liked it. I took accordion lessons when I was 9 for about a year. And then I pretty much figured that the accordion wasn't too hip as an instrument. So put that down. I took drum lessons for a while, and I was a drummer for a few years. And then I picked up guitar because I'd broken my wrist in playing street basketball. And while I had the cast on, my brother had a acoustic guitar that he got for Christmas, and I picked that up and started playing it. And when I got the cast off, I knew a drummer that was better than me, so I just stayed with the guitar.
You had this basketball accident on your wrist.
Yeah.
And you were a drummer. Did you have any inkling before the accident of picking up guitar, or were you just very happy being a drummer? Because if you didn't have the accident, maybe none of this would have happened.
Right. I probably would have stayed a drummer. But I was already thinking of putting a band together, and I knew this drummer that I wanted to be in the band, so.
And how did your father, the jazz musician, feel about you getting into a different path and getting into rock and roll?
My dad never really grokked rock and roll, you know. It's he understood it, and after I became a recording artist, he was definitely studied it and listened to pop music a lot more than he had before. But but he's always encouraged my playing. There was a period of time when we were I had left college, and the band wasn't making any money. We starved for about 4 years, and toward that time, you know, he's. Both my parents said, you know, when are you going to get a real job, basically? You know? And that went on until we finally had the first Columbia record come out. And then it was okay. to be a musician.
Yes. Then you had a career going, so
yeah.
Things were okay.
And again, you know, who knew how long it was going to last, but
yeah,
you know, it lasted, yeah.
Okay, so then during the course, your friend was Albert, and you started
right.
the band.
He was my bandmate in college, yes.
Okay, your bandmate in college. And did you tell us about how Blue Oyster Cult came out of that? Was that... My understanding is that wasn't the first iteration of what you guys did.
No, I was fast forwarding by several years there, but
yeah.
Both he and I lasted 2 years at Clarkson College, which is now Clarkson University, which is the engineering school we'd both gone to. After that, I took a communications course on a Long Island college and for another semester before finally giving it up to just try to be a pro musician. And at the point that I'd met Sandy Pearlman, who was an early rock critic in New York and also an aspiring rocker himself, he was the main lyricist and also basically conceived the idea of the first band that we were in, the Soft White Underbelly, which preceded Blue Oyster Cult, but it was essentially mm-hmm. the same personnel with a couple of differences. Since he was a rock critic, he was already being courted by record labels to promote, you know, their artists. So he could get his foot in the door with record companies. So we had what we perceived to be a real chance to get somewhere in the music business. And he was our main lyricist, along with Richard Meltzer at the time, and they were Stony Brook graduates. And we were hanging around at Stony Brook University because our then bass player, Andrew Winters, was in a house that college students rented, basically. He had
yeah.
a room, you know. So that's how I met Sandy. And there's more people involved, too. But
yeah.
It's the thumbnail of it. Yeah.
So if it was essentially the same personnel, then why did you move from calling yourself a Soft White Underbelly to Blue Oyster Cult? And how did that name pop up in your minds? And tell us about the umlaut, too. I'm curious about that.
Okay. Well, the umlaut was a joke, but I'll go back to the Underbelly days. But we made a bunch of demos for New York record companies. We made one at Mercury. We made one at Columbia early on. We made one at Atlantic in... we had gotten signed eventually to Elektra Records as the Soft White Underbelly. Jack Holzman signed us after a club appearance in New York. And this is before Eric Bloom, our vocalist with me, was in the band. The previous vocalist was named Les Bronstein. And Les was, I think Jack Holzman saw Les as like the next Jim Morrison or something, because he had this, you know, kind of charismatic, stream of conscious rap kind of a thing, you know, over improvised music that the band would do. You know, we were like a jam band before there was jam bands. You know, we always thought of ourselves in the Underbelly as the East Coast answer to the West Coast psychedelic bands.
Yeah. So the first Dead.
Us. Yeah. So we got signed by Elektra. We did some recording. And we never really had a record released on Elektra. There was a falling out between Elektra and our management, Sandy, and they shelved those tapes. And then Elektra changed hands a couple of times. Warner Bros. Yeah. bought them, and then they got sold again. I thought those tapes were lost. And then Rhino released them about 30 years after Blue Oyster Cult. So... They weren't gone.
Wow.
And they're good too. If you ever want to hear,
Under the Soft White Underbelly.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're probably on the streaming services. I haven't checked, but they probably.
Okay,
are.
So everybody out there, check it out. It might be on Spotify as we speak.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, you can hear the difference between Blue Oyster Cult and the Soft White Underbelly too.
So there was that upheaval, you then Blue Oyster Cult. So how did that name come to be?
After we failed to get a record on Elektra, we became a bar band for a year just to survive. And that lasted about a year, and then we were just about ready to give it up and try something else. And we got an audition with Columbia, and Clive Davis signed us. And we didn't have a name at that point, so we had to find one. And Blue Oyster Cult was a song title. It was a title of one of Sandy's lyrics. And we took it, you know, I don't think we were totally sold on it in the first 5 minutes or so, but after a while we got really into it.
Well, that's interesting too. I had no idea it came from a song lyric from Sandy,
yes.
But
yeah.
Because even that lyric is not an obvious lyric.
No, but none of Sandy's lyrics are obvious in the sense of you know, the general road of rock and pop. BOC's always gone its own way.
Right. Okay, so behind my shoulder, for those who are watching, you can see the umlaut over the O, the famous umlaut. So you said it was a joke, but is there a story behind that?
I think we were the first umlaut band, but we weren't the last by any measure. You know, I think once we'd done it, the idea of it appealed to a lot of people. So,
oh, there's no question that that's true.
Right.
It became kind of a staple of rock and roll.
Yeah, yeah. We were regarded as heavy metal pioneers, but I think musically we were never heavy metal, you know, as metal became, you know, we were just way too eclectic and different, all kinds of styles, you know, we're all over the place.
No, absolutely. I mean, you look at songs from that we're going to be talking about, Fear the Reaper and then Godzilla is a very different kind of song too. But the eclecticism definitely shines through. I have to ask you, Buck, about Buck Dharma. So your stage name, very much a part of your identity. How did you become known as Buck Dharma?
There was a short period where we all considered taking pseudonyms or stage names. And I think I'm the only person in the band that liked my stage. I took it, you know. At the same point, you know, I wanted everybody that I grew up with to know who it was, so I used to put both my names on the credits, you know.
But yeah.
It's funny having names, you know. It's like having an alter ego a little bit.
Yeah, I need to find something. I need to find something and put some umlauts over it.
I could probably think of a name for you, Peter.
Oh, no. Okay, be kind.
Yeah. No, I mean, not off the top of my head, but you asked me if I wasn't a rocker, what would I do? And one of the things I would enjoy doing is being the guy that names things, you know, patent medicines, you know, products, you know.
You certainly have a way with the words. Obviously, we'll get into the lyrics of Reaper, which are amazing lyrics.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
We are back, everybody, with Buck Dharma of the great classic band Blue Oyster Cult. Obviously, everybody knows this song. It's featured prominently in countless films ranging from Halloween to Gone Girl. I think most people know that Stephen King cites it as the inspiration behind the novel The Stand, and it's actually, the lyrics are quoted at the beginning of the novel, but I think that he actually got some of the lyrics wrong when he did that. You wrote it, you sang it, you played lead guitar on it. Tell us the story, Don. How did that classic, amazing track, how did that all just come out of your mind?
The germ of it literally did come out of my mind. It's the signature guitar riff in the beginning. I just played it, you know, and once I had played it, I turned on the tape recorder because, you know, I knew that it sounded good, you know, so I had that. And coincidentally, it was the first song I'd written on my new 4-track tape recorder, which enabled me to play multiple parts in sync. Before computers, there were tape recorders, and before tape recorders, only professional studios had multi-track recorders. But around that time, must have been about 1974, TAC came out with a 4-track recorder that was affordable. And so that was the first song I'd written on that. The first two lines of lyric, all our times have come here, but now they're gone, just kind of popped into my head. I don't know if I'd thought of Don't Fear the Reaper yet, you know, but at some point I wanted to write about dying at a young age. And because I'd been diagnosed with a heart arrhythmia and I was a little worried about it, turns out it wasn't a big deal. You know, it was manageable. But I was thinking about mortality and imagining that there would be life after death, and, you know, and that, especially from a romantic sense, you know, that you know, your partner wouldn't be alone. There would be a way to, you know, get over that hump of the here and now, you know. So that's the imagination of the story.
You were just playing your guitar.
Yeah.
You picked it up one day and
yeah. Well, actually, I was in front of the machine and I was trying to think of something to put down, you know. Yeah.
Really? So yeah. You were intentionally trying to come up with something at that time.
Right. I was songwriting, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But do you recall the moment when that came out of you, that riff?
I remember the time and place. Yeah, I was, you know, I had the machine on a little upright piano, a console piano, and
yeah,
I was sitting on the piano bench playing guitar, you know, and it was going right into the machine.
And so when you first played that riff, you said that the first couple lyrics came out roughly at the same time?
Yeah, well, I recorded a passage of the guitar riff, just basically the intro, and you know, and I sang the first couple of lines on another track over that, you know, and I built the song from there, basically.
So when you were saying that because you had this heart arrhythmia, you were already thinking about, you know, death at a very young age.
Yeah, well, it just got me thinking about the whole dying thing, and like, you know, I think most people when they're sentient, you know, they don't want to not be, you know.
Yeah.
They like to think that there's, you know, something beyond, you know, beyond dirt.
Yes.
Yeah.
When was that thought about writing a song about premature death or about death, was that present with you when you were intentionally recording and the riff came out and the first two lines come out? Were you like, was that whole mindset with you at that point?
Well, fairly early on, you know, I knew the song was Don't Fear the Reaper, and the job was to tell a story, you know, that was, you know, engaging. And I thought of it in a literary or a visual sense, you know. I mean, I could see pictures in my head of the story as it unfolded, you know. So
did the lyrics flow easily? Is this a song that you wrote in a day, 2 days, a week, a month?
It took me about 6 weeks to finish the story, you know, to just make, you know, get the form and you know, and find out how it wraps up, you know, how is the happy ever after, you know, achieved, you know, and basically, you know, there, what happens is, you know, the guy comes back over the, over whatever the separates what I imagine is out there and what we are experiencing here. And he gets his gal and they go away.
Yeah. And when it first started flowing out of you, that first riff, did you know that you had something special?
No, not until it was done. Actually, not until it was recorded at the record plant in New York did I realize that, you know, it really was something, you know. I mean, I made a demo of it on the four-track machine, and the band did a great job translating that demo to the Agents of Fortune version. But it's basically the same arrangement. It's not very different, you know. So, yeah, I mean, when I had the demo, I knew it was good.
Is that demo available anywhere?
Yeah, it's on one of our extended versions of the Agents of Fortune LP.
Yeah. There are so many misconceptions also about that song. And rather than identify what a lot of people think that is, you know, what the song is about, how would you describe what Don't Fear the Reaper is a story about?
The biggest misconception is that it's about suicide, and it's really not. And I think just referencing Romeo and Juliet makes people think that. And I understand that how they do think that, but that's not certainly what I was. Other than Romeo and Juliet, you assume got somewhere where they were going, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the biggest leap of faith you have to take, you know.
Right. So you were alluding to the fact that it's really a love song and about love transcending death, right?
Exactly.
So for everybody out there, it's this wonderful love song about love transcendent and about this couple that, you know, it goes on, but in an overall very haunting kind of sense. It's just incredible. One thing I have to ask you about, You use the number 40,000, and how did that, about 40,000 every day?
I just imagine that's the number of people that are just passing away every day. You know, I don't know what the actual number is. I knew that I needed a number that I could sing, that had the right cadence, you know, the right syllables. You know, you wouldn't want like a complex number with 10 syllables in it, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And how do you feel about the song today?
I'm not tired of it. You know, even after 40-odd years, I'm not tired of it. So that's good. Yeah.
Is there anything that I haven't teased out just about the creation of the song itself? What was going through your mind or your life at the time?
To replicate the impact of the Reaper would be nice. You know, but it's funny the way the song happened. It's not like I could just command another one to come into being, you know. I have to thank the universe or whatever, just people's perception of it, that they dig it as much as they have. I mean, I didn't know, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. It's a moment of inspiration. My understanding is that the guitar solo and the guitar rhythm sections were recorded in one take. Is that correct?
Yeah, the middle solo was recorded in one take.
And then how did the, you know, there's this, the bridge section, which is...
Which we're talking about, the solo section, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So when you have that section that come in, that's a little bit disorienting.
Right. Now that's supposed that represents the transition and that's when the skies part and all this, you know, metaphysical stuff happens.
Yeah. And that was all recorded in one take, which is, I've read enough about interviews of other artists who have recorded your song, and they find it virtually impossible to play that bridge.
Yeah. Well, even I don't play it exactly like the record. You know, I don't play any. When you see me live, you know, I'm improvising most of the lead sections on every song, not just the Reaper. So,
yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, that said, the structure of the bridge was planned, and the band recorded it with me on that. And when I did the lead, I don't know if I'd done takes before the one we kept, but it was basically done in one pass. And it's not that I don't do it the other way, where you take a bunch of takes and then you comp them together. I work that way now with the ease of digital editing. You know, it's fun to do that, especially on the engineering side. But in the case of Don't Fear the Reaper, it just happened to be one take. That's what it was.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Yeah. Everybody knows it's become such a part of, it's just such an iconic phrase now that, you know, I got a fever and the only prescription is more cowbell. So
more cowbell.
So yeah. Buck, when did you first learn about Will Ferrell and the gang at Saturday Night Live doing the famous Bruce Dickinson cowbell skit?
My wife's mom called us up about halfway into the sketch, said, "Turn on Saturday Night Live now." We just saw the end of it, and then, you know, I forget how long it took to see it again. In other words, we hadn't videotaped it in the moment, but somebody did, and we saw it soon thereafter. You know, so they didn't tell us they were going to do it. You know,
yeah.
I don't know what Will Ferrell was thinking when he came up with the idea for that sketch, but it's hilarious. You know, it's still hilarious. You know, even after all these years.
Oh, it's hilarious. He was inspired. Clearly, he was inspired to come up with something like that, and it really has become part of the vernacular that's transcended the Will Ferrell skit where. There are moments where people say, "I need more cowbell" to just about anything.
Right. No, it comes in handy. I mean, I say it myself.
So how did you feel about it when you first saw it?
My first reaction was relief that it was funny and that SNL didn't slag the band because they didn't, you know, they made fun of us, but it was sort of gentle fun.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. So the SNL part and the more cowbell, and I'm picturing Will Ferrell right now with his shirt riding up, you know, riding up his stomach as he's in everybody's face with the cowbell.
Right. But, of course, the star of the sketch is Christopher Walken. You know, he's
yeah.
The guy,
well, of course,
thrust, you know.
And who is his name was Bruce Dickinson in the sketch,
right.
But Bruce Dickinson wasn't
the actual producer of the Reaper, but he was on this compilation record, and Bruce is a Sony legacy producer of compilations, basically, is what he does. And so they just took his name off the record jacket that they bought at wherever sold CDs in those days, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's
funny. Where they got all the costuming and stuff from the picture on the cover of that CD.
Yeah, that's classic. So yeah. Will Ferrell just got the name wrong, but it's become part of legend.
Right.
So, but let's go into the studio about the decision to have the cowbell be as prominently featured. So do you know how that came to be?
Yeah, the cowbell was added sort of late in the recording. And the idea was belonged to David Lucas, who is one of the three co-producers of that record. And he just thought it, he thought that the tune could use a little four on the floor consistency, you know, to sort of glue everything together. And to this day, there's conflicting memories of who actually played the cowbell on the cut. I don't think I was in the studio when it was recorded, you know.
So everybody wants to be that legend.
I don't know who played the cowbell. It was either David or Albert Bouchard. I think that's the two people that are likely. David could have played it himself. But anyway, it's not, in fact, that loud, the cowbell.
Yeah, I was going
to
ask you to
sell this. Which makes the whole idea of the sketch even funnier to me, you know, because, you know, when he says you could use more, well, you could. You could hear it louder, you know, because it's not that loud, you know. I just want to ask Will Ferrell, you know, you're right, it's not that loud. How did the idea occur to you to make that sketch?
Yeah, and then Bruce Dickinson, a.k.a. Christopher Walken, in his inimitable fashion, which makes it classic. Yeah. But there's another thing. We talked about when you were a drummer as a young kid and you hurt yourself playing basketball, and that transformed you into picking up the guitar, which altered the course of your career and your life.
Right.
And then you also have something like in this particular song, a choice is made by a producer to elevate the sound of a cowbell, and it's become part of just overall lore. And it's amazing how decisions like that happen. And, you know, your arrhythmia led you to be in the mindset of creating one of the most classic and iconic songs of all time.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't everybody live that way? You know, it just seems like my whole life has been walking through a door that opens, you know, rather than really trying to force, you know, my vision or idea of life on the world. You know, just the world grants you opportunities or forks in roads, and you take one, you know, and that seems to be the way it is, at least my experience.
No, absolutely. I think that's really well said. It's that rather than resist, go to the places where it's not resistant. We are back with Buck, and I want to ask a little bit, Buck, to wrap things up, about your 50th anniversary tour.
Well, this whole year is our 50th anniversary. We're doing a couple of special events for it. First one is the European tour. We, ever since 2020, we've been trying to do this arena tour with Deep Purple in the UK. And it was canceled in 2020 for COVID, and in 2021 for COVID. So 2022, it'll probably happen, you know, barring any unforeseen difficulties. And then after that tour, we have two nights in Paris, which we're going to record and video, and that'll be part of the 50th. And then also in New York on September 21, 22, and 23, we're doing three nights at Sony Hall, and we are going to play the first three albums, one each night in their entirety, in addition to the regular program.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
And do you enjoy being on the road?
I don't like traveling as much as I used to, just because it gets more and more difficult, but playing and singing, I really like it, you know.
Yeah,
as long as I'll do it.
Absolutely. And I saw on your website that you're doing a Fear the Reaper show on SiriusXM for Halloween.
Yeah, we've done that a couple of years now. It's, you know, I mean, Reaper is sort of a Halloween staple in a lot of ways, you know. I went into a Home Depot, and there was a sign. The guy going there,
You better be getting royalties for that.
Yeah, you know, it's not big money, but you get something.
Yes, you do. So, Dodd, because it is, that song is everywhere.
Yeah.
Does it still bring a smile to your face as you walk around and just experience it?
Yeah. It's funny. I just got back from Nashville. My wife had never been to Nashville, so we went down there and spent a couple of days. And I took her to a place on Broadway down in the entertainment area there, and we played a place called a Sky Deck on the rooftop. It's a big rooftop on a big entertainment dining complex. Anyway, so I took her up there, and we go out on the deck, and it's about 3 in the afternoon, and what comes on the PA but Don't Fear the Reaper? You know, it's almost like I planned that, but I didn't.
Yeah.
It just happened.
Yeah. And she said, sure, sure, Don, sure.
No, we just laughed. We just laughed. We thought it was funny. We took a little video, and I lip-synced part of it for the video, you know.
Your last studio album was 2020's The Symbol Remains.
Right.
Do you have new songs that you'll be recording in for an upcoming album?
We haven't committed to making another record because the Symbol Remains was a stupendous effort we did. There's 14 tracks on it, and they're all great. It's all killer, no filler. And to top that would be a big mountain to climb. You know, we may do more, but no promises. We'll see.
Yeah, yeah. So you'll be playing a lot of those songs on the tour, too.
Yes, we will. Yeah, we play 4 songs now, and we'll probably do more this summer.
Okay, gotcha. Great. Yeah. And then when you think about your body of work and just your overall experience as a musician, is there anything, any particular experience that really stands out? Like, that was a special moment in my life. And I know you've had so many of them, but is there anything that in particular really sticks out?
You know, I'd like to tell you a neat story, but I don't know. I've been just sort of, you know, grateful for the whole continuum of it. You know, I'd say audience wise, we peaked in the early 80s. You know, we headlined the ballpark in San Diego, and it was like 70, 80,000 people, something like that. And that was the most we'd ever drawn, you know, as a headliner. And now, you know, we play casinos, we play state fairs, we play medium sized theaters, you know, and we play clubs sometimes. So, and I still enjoy every moment of it, you know.
Yeah, just different experiences.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this before we go. You have bands like Pink Floyd, who just made their songs available for the first time for TikTok, as an example. And of course, there was the famous story of Fleetwood Mac, and Dreams was made, was brought back to life in a very significant way because there was a video that was on TikTok. And so you see a lot of that happening. And then you see a song like Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill,
yeah,
that just has blown up on the charts and is number one on iTunes because of Stranger Things. So when you think about TikTok or new forms or new technology, is this something that, especially given how technically minded you are and you're an engineer by trade, is this interesting to you? Is it fascinating to think of new ways for your music to come out?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that's accidental. I mean, no one saw ringtones coming when that was thing, you know, in the 90s or whatever it was. And the internet has totally changed the record business compared to what it was, you know.
Yeah.
It's disrupted it, you know. It hurt it, and then I think it's coming around again. I think streaming has finally become a almost, if not in fact, equitable way of making music for a living. You know,
yeah.
Whereas when in the Napster days, it was just killing the record business. You know?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
So,
well,
yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons why investors are buying up song catalogs and stuff is because they see the future of all media, you know, that musicians and writers will be compensated in some small way every time music is used in the future.
Yeah, well, and that's a great way to end up in terms of just like time, the reason those kind of deals are happening because of the ability to extend the life of these great songs and resource them in a certain way. And Don't Fear the Reaper doesn't need any help. You know, that's a perennial classic, like you said, and that's timeless. And it really was, Buck, it was really a pleasure to have you lay out the story behind the song and join me on the podcast for this month. So thanks for joining.
Yeah, well, thanks. Thank you, Peter. You know, and I'm really grateful to have written The Reaper. And again, kind of surprised that it's what it is.
Well, it's top 10 for me, the perfect song. Thanks so much, Buck.
Okay.
That was Don Roser, a.k.a. Buck Dharma of Blue Oyster Cult, telling the story behind the band's dark, haunting, and timeless masterpiece, Don't Fear the Reaper. I'm your host, Peter Chadi of Deep Cuts Media. Tune in next week for another episode of new interviews mixed with classic encore episodes, and reach out to me at peter@deepcutsmedia.com if you want to add your own icons to the list. And make sure to like, subscribe, and share each episode and the show itself. And until next week, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song, and happy Halloween.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.